harm. I reached the Gull Cove Mini-Mart at 2 p.m. The business had been housed in an enormous shambling structure covered with cedar shingles, an appealing mix of modern and traditional with a few Cape Cod elements thrown in for good measure. The building had also housed a 24-hour diner, a curio shop, and a tiny two-station beauty salon. Even at a distance, it was clear the entire place had been closed down. I could see windows boarded over, and the asphalt parking lot was cracked and faded to a chalky gray. The surrounding grass was a dull brown, with assorted weeds and wildflowers growing to knee height. On the hillside behind the building, a lone tree had died and stood now like a scarecrow, its twisted branches raised toward the sky as though to beckon birds. The population of Gull Cove was pegged at 100, but I couldn't for the life of me spot so much as one. I parked my car near the front steps and got out. The wide wooden deck creaked under my feet. A notice posted on the main door announced that the complex was closed for renovations. Someone had drawn a happy face in pencil with the mouth turned down. Someone else had written, "Who cares?" in ballpoint pen. A third party, perhaps human, had taken a big dump near the padlocked door. I peered through the mini-mart's front window, which was dusty and streaked where winter rains had hammered at the plate glass. The interior was stripped. Not one fixture, counter, or display case remained. It looked like the renovations would be going on for some time. I turned and stared at the road. The Gull Cove complex was the only commercial structure for miles, 100 feet from the highway and a natural stopping-off point for travelers who needed to take a break. It was easy to see why someone thumbing a ride might get dropped off in passing. Perhaps after donuts and coffee, our Jane Doe found a lift as far as Lompoc, which had turned out to be the end of the line for her. I went back to the car and checked my notes, looking for Roxanne Fott's last known address, Q Street in Lompoc, 30 minutes to the north. Seemed like a long way for her to travel for a clerking job. I fired up the engine and hit the road again, heading north, the Pacific Ocean on my left. Today, the swells were low and without chop, the color a darker reflection of the blue sky above. Idly, I thought about Gran's house. It was possible I'd catch a glimpse of the place if I happened to pass that way. Surely it was visible from the highway if you knew where to look. I turned on the car radio to distract myself. I reached the outskirts of Lompoc. The town is flat and compact. A one-story panorama of wide streets and small houses. A constant wind blows off the ocean, funneled by the rolling hills that cradle the town. 3 miles to the north is Vandenberg Village, and beyond that, Vandenberg Air Force Base. The entire valley is given over to horse farms and cattle ranches, much of the agricultural land planted to fields of commercial flowers, many of them grown for seeds. Though I had no idea what I was looking at, I could see stretches of bright yellow and vibrant pink. Beyond them were acres of what appeared to be baby's breath. Many farms were being sold to real estate developers, the sweet peas, poppies, and larkspurs being crowded out by crops of 3-bedroom houses in neatly planted rows. The town itself boasts the Lompoc Municipal Pool and a substantial civic center along with all the standard businesses, the Viva Thrift Shop, banks, attorney's offices, automotive and plumbing supplies, retail stores and gas stations, coffee shops, pharmacies, and medical complexes. Lompoc is a base town with neighborhoods of temporary residents whose military careers will always move them from place to place, like pieces on a game board. It was hard to see what people did for amusement. There wasn't a bowling alley, a concert hall, or a movie house in sight. Maybe local culture consisted of everyone renting videotapes of last year's money-losing movies. Q Street wasn't hard to find, coming as it did between P and R. The address was on the left side of the street, and I slowed as I approached. The house, resting on cinder blocks, was an oblong wooden box covered with sheets of asphalt siding imprinted to look like dark red brick. A porch, stretched across the front, sagged in the middle. Two whitewashed tires served as makeshift planters from which pink geranium spilled. An old white claw-foot tub had been upended and half-buried in the yard. A blue-robed plaster Madonna stood in the shelter of the porcelain rim. I pulled in at the curb and got out. An old man in overalls was in the front yard bathing a dog. The man looked 90 if a day and was still staunchly constructed. He'd strung a garden hose through the half-opened kitchen window, and I assumed the other end was attached to the faucet. As I crossed the grass, he paused in his work, releasing the hose nozzle, shutting off the stream of water. He had a square, jowly face, a lumpy nose, and a straight, nearly lipless mouth. His hair was slicked back, plastered down with pomade, and even then so thin I could see through to his scalp. His skin was mottled brown from sun damage, interspersed with patches of red. His blue eyes were vivid dots under pale, sparse brows. The air smelled like wet dog hair and a pungent flea soap. A medium-sized pooch of no determinate breed stood knee-deep in a galvanized tub. He looked skinny and frail with his coat plastered to his frame, thin to transparency. Dead fleas like pepper seasoned the flesh underneath. The dog trembled, whining, and wouldn't quite meet my eyes. I kept my gaze averted so as not to embarrass him. The old man said, "Help you?" His voice was surprisingly high-pitched for a man his size. "I hope so. I'm looking for Roxanne Fott, and this is the only address I have. Any idea where she is?"
"Ought to. I'm her dad," he said. "And who might you be?"
I showed him my card. He squinted and then shook his head.
"What's that say? Sorry, but I don't have my specs on me."
"I'm a private investigator from Santa Teresa."
"What do you want with Roxanne?"
"I need information on an old case. Apparently, a girl came into the Gull Cove Minimart when Roxanne was working there in 1969. I'd like to ask her some questions about the incident." He squeezed the hose nozzle, and the spray of water showered like a light rain over the dog's back and haunches.
"That the one got killed?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, I guess that's all right, then. I know a sheriff's deputy came by a couple of times asking the very same thing."
"Oh, you're talking about Stacy Oliphant, the guy I'm working with. Is your daughter still in the area?"
"Close enough. How about this? I'll go give a call and see if she's willing to talk to you. Otherwise, there's no point."
"That'd be great." He laid the hose aside, lifted the dog from the tub, and set him on the grass. The dog gave one of those profound total body shakes, flinging water in all directions until his coat stood out in spikes. The old man picked up a heavy towel and gave the dog a vigorous rub, then swaddled him in the towel and handed him to me.
"This is Ralph."
Since I was hoping to curry favor, I took the dog without protest. I could feel warm doggy bathwater seeping from the towel through my shirt front. Ralph lay in my arms, a damp bundle of bones, as trusting as a baby, his eyes pinned on mine. His tongue flopped out the side of his mouth, and I could swear he smiled. I jiggled him a bit, which he seemed to enjoy. I really don't understand how animals persuade human beings to behave like this. The old man reappeared, closing the door carefully. He made his way down the steps. He wasn't quick on his feet, but he seemed to get the job done. He had a scrap of paper in his hand.
"She's home right now and said it's okay to give you this."
I handed the dog over and took the paper, glancing down at the phone number and address.
"Thanks." "It's a little house off the highway. You go down here about 10 blocks until you hit North Street and then turn right. Once you get to Riverside, you turn right again. She's about 5 blocks down."
Roxanne Fott had turned her front porch into an outdoor room with pale sisal carpet, a dark green painted porch swing, 2 white wicker rockers, occasional tables, and a double-sided magazine rack, one half stuffed with issues of People and the other with copies of Better Homes and Gardens. 5 terracotta pots of bright orange marigolds lined the edge of the porch. When I arrived, she was sitting on the swing with a bottle of beer and a freshly lit cigarette. The house itself was white frame and completely nondescript. There were windows and doors in all the proper places, but nothing that made the house distinct. Roxanne was in her 60s and attractive, though the creases in her face were exaggerated by all the makeup she wore. Her hair was, in the main, a coppery blonde, showing gray at the roots where 4 inches of new growth formed a wide band. Her brows were plucked to thin arches, and dark eyes were lined in black. The smoking had darkened her teeth, but they were otherwise straight and uniform, suggesting caps. She wore a long-sleeve navy t-shirt with the sleeves pushed up, jeans, and tennis shoes without socks. She took a sip of beer and pointed at me with the bottle. "You have to be the one Pop just called about. Come on up and have a seat." "Kinsey Milhone, I appreciate your seeing me on such short notice. I wasn't sure where you were living, so I started with him."
"I've been in town all my life. I guess I don't have much sense of adventure. My great aunt died and left me just enough money to get the house paid off. I can survive without working if I watch my step."
She paused and picked up a strand of two-toned hair, which she studied critically.
"You can see I quit going to the beauty shop. Cheaper to color it myself when I get around to it. I can't give these up," she said, gesturing with her cigarette. "I smoke so long, I'm probably doomed anyway. Might as well enjoy."
She coughed once, loosening something deep in her chest.
"What can I help you with? Pop says you're here about that girl got killed. What was it, 20 years ago?"
"Just about. 18 in August."
"You know what's interesting about her? She's got a grip on folks. Here she is dead all this time, and she still has people out there wondering who she is and how to get her back where she belongs."
"And who killed her?" I added.
"Yeah, well, good luck on that. You got your work cut out. Sit. Can I get you a beer?"
"I'm doing fine right now, thanks." I settled on one of the white wicker rockers, which creaked under my weight. "I can see where you'd want to spend the day out here watching traffic go by. Nice."
"That's the thing about retirement. People keep asking me, don't you miss work? Well, no way, Jose. I could go the rest of my life and never leave this porch. I'm so busy as it is, I can't figure out how I ever had time for a job. Between housework and errands, there's half the day gone right there."
"What else do you do?"
"Read. I work in the yard, play bridge with some gals I've known for years. How about you? You like the work you do?"
"I'm not that crazy about being stuck indoors, but the field work's fun."
"So now, what can I tell you that you don't already know?"
One thing I was curious about. Gull Cove is 30 miles south. Seems like a long way to drive for work you could have found in town. Roxanne coughed again, clearing her throat. As with other smokers I've known, her coughing was habitual and didn't seem to warrant a remark.
That's easy. I was diddling the owner. That's how I got hired," she laughed. "Seemed like a good idea at the time. He moved on to someone else, and I got fired. Big surprise. My fault entirely. It's like Pop used to say, don't shit in your own post-toasties, Roxanne."
"Live and learn."
"You got that right. Anyway, I was working 7 to 3. This was summer and hotter than blue blazes, even with the breeze coming in off the ocean. You know the place at all?"
"Actually, I stopped off there on the drive up."
"Then you've seen for yourself. Not a shade tree in sight. Building stuck there on the side of the hill. By August, the sun's hot enough to boil water. Anyway, this was a Friday morning. I remember because I got paid once a week, and I had bills up to here. So I'm working away. It's just me by my lonesome. Business was never heavy, and I could handle it myself. This gal comes in. She's checking the aisles, walking up and down like she has some shopping to do. Then I see her move to the rear where we had a coffee machine and a self-serve case of deli sandwiches and sweets. Customers would serve themselves, then come to the register to pay once they had everything they needed. We kept tables and chairs outside on the deck, and most of them would take their purchases out there and watch the ocean while they ate. You had to look over the 4 lanes of traffic whizzing by on the road, but you could see it all the same.
Different every day. I never got tired of the sight myself. Any rate, she helped herself to a cup of coffee and a donut and had both of them scarfed down by the time she got to the front. She'd tossed the cup somewhere in the back, maybe thinking I wouldn't notice she just had her fill. Next thing I know, she's halfway out the door. I rang up the charges, and then I caught up with her. That's when she told me she was broke. Well, hell, I thought. I've been broke in my day, and I don't begrudge anyone some brew and a bite to eat, so I told her I'd take care of it. She said, "Thanks, I mean that." Those were her exact words. "Thanks, I mean that." And off she went. Couldn't have taken more than 4 minutes, all told. And I'm talking from the time she came in. I'm surprised you remembered her at all. Somebody tries to rent out without paying? Oh, you better believe I remembered, especially when she turned up dead. She paused to stub out one cigarette and light another. Pardon my manners. I hope this doesn't bother you. Do you smoke? No, but we're outside, and I'm upwind. What else do you recall? Anything in particular? I wondered how anyone could remember so brief an encounter after so much time had passed.
Like what? Ask me questions. It's easier that way.
How old would you say?
20s.
Not in her teens?
Could have been. She was a good-sized girl.
You mean fat?
I wouldn't say fat, but she was big. Big wrist bones, big feet. Had what Pop would call good childbearing hips.
You remember her clothes?
Oh, Lord, I think I gave that sheriff's detective all the same information at the time. Why don't you ask him?
I thought I'd go back over and see if anything new comes to light, I said.
Pants and a blousy shirt, you know, big sleeves.
Belt? She feigned irritation, giving me a mock cross look.
You get right down to the nitty-gritty, don't you? Scars, moles, other identifying marks. What do you want? I only saw the girl up close once.
Sorry, I take it she wasn't wearing a belt.
Don't think so.
I could feel her withdraw and knew I needed to pull her back. What about her shoes?
I'd say boots if I had to guess.
It's not multiple choice, just whatever comes to mind. Take the pants. Were they patterned or plain? She brightened.
Now, that I do know. It's what I told the cops back then. Daisies.
You remember the color? She shrugged.
Daisy-colored, you know, yellow and white. Probably some green in there someplace. Is that important?
I'm just groping around. What about the shirt?
Plain. I hope you don't intend to ask me every little thing.
I smiled. Really, I don't. Was the shirt dark or light?
Dark blue voile.
Which is what? Sorry, but I don't know the term.
I'm not sure myself, but I know that's right because I went back and looked it up.
You kept notes?
I kept the clipping from the paper. It's in the other room.
I could hear a dim alarm bell ring. What I was getting was rehearsed. Did you get the impression she was local or on the road?
Traveling, definitely. I saw her hitchhiking earlier when I was coming into work. I'm sure she hadn't eaten in a while. She wolfed her food right down.
She could have been stoned, I said.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. She probably was, come to think of it. That might explain where her money went. She spent it all on dope.
Just a possibility. I wonder how far she managed to travel without funds. Or do you think she had the money and just didn't choose to spend it on food?
Hard to say. If I hadn't volunteered to pay, she'd have tennis-shoed the place, so I'd have been stuck either way. Bet she panhandled, too. Your age, you probably don't remember those days.
Actually, I do. I was in my late teens.
Point is, all those hippies hung out, cadging any change you had. Smoking these big fat joints. I forget now what they called them. Thumbs, I think. Me, I wasn't into that. Well, maybe a little grass, but never any LSD.
I murmured a response and then said, "Was she wearing jewelry?"
"Nope, don't think so."
"No watch or bracelet, maybe earrings?"
"Oh, I remember now. No earrings. Her left earlobe was torn through, like somebody grabbed a hoop and ripped it right off."
"Was the injury recent?" Nope. It was all healed up, but it was definitely split. What about her fingernails? Bitten to the quick. Nearly made me sick. She wasn't all that clean, and she'd picked at her cuticles until they bled. You ever see that? Nails so short the fingertips look all puffy. It's enough to make you lose your lunch. And you're sure you'd never seen her around town before? Not before, and not since. How'd you happen to get in touch with the sheriff's department? I didn't happen to do anything. I read about the body in the paper and remembered she'd been in. Like I said before, the incident stuck in my mind because she tried to pull a fast one. What made you so sure it was the same girl? Who else could it have been? Ah, well, this has been a big help. I appreciate your time. I reached out to shake her hand. She complied reluctantly. Don't you believe me? I noticed you didn't take notes. I got it all up here, I said, tapping my head. Once back in my car, I checked my road map. Roxanne was still on the porch looking out at me, probably wondering at the delay. Maybe she thought I was finally taking notes, recording the bullshit recollections she'd constructed over the years. I didn't think she'd lied. She simply told her story too often. By now, she was either vamping like crazy or remembering someone else. I folded the map in half, trying to gauge how far I might be from the ranch. If I continued south on Riverside and made a dogleg right, I'd hit the road that angled south and east, connecting with Highway 101 just about at Gull Cove. According to the map, the road was called Calle Le Grand, presumably named after my great-grandfather Le Grand, whose 23,000 acres filled a sizable chunk of the area. Twisting, hair-like blue lines indicated creeks running through the land. I started the VW and waved at Roxanne once as I pulled away. The last I saw of her, she was sitting on the porch swing, a fresh cigarette in hand, taking yet another sip of beer. I picked up Calle Le Grand and followed the road south, through low, rolling gold hills that would turn as green as Ireland when the rains returned. In the areas where there were no structures in sight, I fancied I was looking through the eyes of the early settlers, marveling at the acres of untouched land, bare and silent, except for the cries of birds. I missed the turn to the ranch and had to circle back when I realized I'd gone too far. On the return, I saw the side road where Stacy and Dolan and I had met Arne Johansson. The gate now stood open, and a haze of dust on the gravel road suggested that a vehicle had recently passed that way. I turned in, driving slowly, my attention drawn to the gully where Jane Doe's body had been found. I could see now that a section of the road angled off to the left, ending in a cul-de-sac, and I remembered the passing reference to the VW van that was seen parked in the turnaround. Also a red convertible with out-of-state plates. Offhand, I couldn't remember the name of the fellow who'd called it in, but the report might bear revisiting, as Arne had suggested. Somebody Vogel. I'd have to look it up. I eased the car up the hill, following the route Arne had taken in his jeep. I was really hoping the no trespassing signs didn't apply to me. The house came into view, looking like something in an old horror film. I parked in the driveway and approached with a curious mix of anxiety and excitement. Bare wooden trellises affixed to the porch rails at intervals suggested that roses or morning glories might have climbed there once. Now the beds were overgrown. I climbed the front porch stairs, which seemed remarkably sound. The house, though a shambles, had been built to last. I remembered talk at some point of moving the house into the city limits, restoring it as a possible tourist attraction. I could see where the city would be reluctant to make a claim. Even the idea of renovating the house in situ would be an expensive proposition. To what end? I tried the front door, and to my surprise, I found it unlocked. I pushed it open and went in, assaulted by the dense smell of soot and mildew. I spent the next 30 minutes wandering from floor to floor, sometimes awed at the grandeur that remained. High ceilings, the sweeping staircase in the foyer, all the marble and mahogany still gracing the rooms. A large butler's pantry opened into a vast kitchen with servants' quarters built on behind. A second staircase led up to the second floor from there. I could feel memory stir. Vague images, shapeless and filled with shadows, moved at the edge of my vision. I could hear sounds, talking and laughing in another room, without being able to distinguish the words. I was standing on the wide second-floor landing when I heard someone walking in the hall below. From the bottom of the stairs, someone called, "Kinsey!" For one wonderful moment, the voice was my mother's, and she'd returned from the dead. Chapter 7. I crossed to the banister and peered over the railing. Tasha stood in the stairwell looking up.
"I saw your car parked outside."
"I'll come down." I descended the stairs, embarrassed that I'd been caught poking around the house uninvited. She'd taken a seat on the third step up, leaning against the wall. I settled on the same step, sitting close to the rail. "How'd you know I was here?"
"Arne saw your car pull in and called me. My office isn't that far."
She was dressed in lawyer clothes, a crisp navy blue pantsuit with a white silk shell under the two-button jacket. She wore pearls. I'd always heard you could tell real pearls from fake by running them across your teeth, but I wasn't clear what information that was meant to impart. I thought it'd be rude to ask if I could bite her necklace. She had dark eyes, delicately enhanced with a smoky eyeliner, a straight nose where mine was ever so faintly bumpy from having been broken twice. Her dark hair was tastefully highlighted with blonde and pulled into a rope at the nape of her neck. I could see a bow of red chiffon peeking into view from the hair clip behind. It's odd to see someone you know looks like you. The face we see in the mirror is always reversed, so that our impression of ourselves is flipped left to right. If you stand in front of a mirror and put your right index finger against your right cheek, the mirror will tell you you're touching left to left. The only way you can see yourself as you appear to others is to hold a mirror to the mirror and check your image in that. What I saw now of Tasha was what others saw of me. Already I liked her face a lot better than mine. I usually ignore my own looks, not from distaste, but from a sense of despair. So many women have mastered an arsenal of beauty products. Foundation, powder, blusher, eyeshadow, pencils for lining their eyes, brows, and lips. As a rule, I avoid makeup, having little experience with the selection and application process. It was clear at a glance that Tasha knew her stuff. I couldn't identify all the kinds of goop on her face, but she tinted herself with care. Her skin had a healthy glow, her cheeks showed a hint of pink, and her eyes looked enormous because her lashes were so thick. I could see her assessing me while I assessed her. We smiled at the same time, which only furthered the notion we were looking at ourselves. We had identical teeth. She said, "After our telephone conversation, I had a long talk with Mom. Her version of events is different." "Oh, really? How so?" "She says your parents made that trip to meet with Grand and Granddaddy in hopes of a reconciliation. They were killed on the way. Grand blamed herself. Aunt Jin blamed her, too. Mom says Grand tried to keep in touch, but Jin was having none of it. Finally, Grand gave up, but only after years of trying to make contact." "Bullshit. I don't believe it." "I'm not asking you to believe. I'm telling you what Mother said." "Well, of course she'd say that. She's still tied into Grand. How can you afford to think ill of someone who has the power to pull the rug out from under you? You'd do just about anything to see them as good, no matter what they've done." "Kinsey, if you really want to find out what went on back then, you can't start by rejecting the messages you don't want to hear. There are two sides to every story. That's why we have the courts, to settle disputes." "All right, compare this to litigation. That'll win you points," I said. "Most people can't stand lawyers. I'm one of the few with any respect for the trade." I stopped. I stared down at the floor for a moment and then shook my head. "I'm sorry. Forget it. I didn't mean to get into it with you again." Tasha smiled slightly. I told you we couldn't talk without hassling. You set me off. That's not my intent. I know. The hard part is that neither of us has any concrete proof. We can do this did-to, did-not routine until the cows come home. It's Gran's word against Aunt Jin's or Mother's word against your mom's. There is no fact of the matter. Probably not. Just keep an open mind. That's really all I ask. I'm afraid it's too late for that. My mind's been made up since the day I met Liza. I wasn't interested then, and I'm probably not interested now. At least you use the word probably. That's progress, isn't it? You used to be adamant. Now you're obdurate. Which means what? Resistant, but less flinty. It's a big improvement. The comment seemed patronizing, but I shrugged it off. Why take offense when she might not have actually meant it that way? I said, it feels like unfinished business, and that bothers me. Regardless of how it comes out, I'd like to think I'm doing the right thing. That works both ways. We're having to go back and revisit the past, which is good for all of us. The point is, we have time to work this out. 32 years of it so far. So, what's 32 more? We can't settle a long-standing quarrel in a few casual talks. She glanced at her watch and then rose. I have to get back to work. Did you finish the tour? I pulled myself up. Essentially. I hoped I'd remember something, but I'm drawing a blank. The two of us paused simultaneously to brush off the backs of our pants. He crossed to the front door, our shoes making scratching sounds in the grit that had accumulated on the marble floor. She said, "What do you think of the place?" "It must have been beautiful in its day." Tasha turned back, letting her eyes travel across the foyer and up the stairs. "You know, Grand moved out shortly after Aunt Rita's death. Rita Cynthia Kinsey was my mother's maiden name." "I didn't know that." "Granddaddy Kinsey was fit to be tied, but she finally got her way. That's when they bought the house in town. You remember him at all?" I shook my head. "Maybe I can find some family photographs." "I'd like that. I don't think I've ever seen pictures of anyone." Aunt Jin discounted sentiment as a form of sniveling. She refused to let either of us sink to such depths. She was tough. That she was. "Well, I better go." "Me too," I said. "I do have one request. I know you've already talked to your mother about me, but please don't bring Grand into this. My lips are sealed." It was 4:35 by the time I reached Santa Teresa. I made a stop at the public library, leaving my car in the adjacent four-story parking structure. My conversation with Roxanne Fott had raised unsettling questions. Namely, what did she know and when did she know it? I wondered if there was any way to check. I trotted down the carpeted stairs to the periodicals room, where I asked the reference librarian for the microfilm records of the Santa Teresa Dispatch from the week of August 3, 1969. Since the body was found that Sunday, I didn't expect the news to hit the paper for another day or two. Once I had the box of film in hand, I sat down at the machine and unreeled the strip, which I threaded under the lens, catching the sprocket holes. I hand-cranked it until the strip caught properly and then pressed a button and watched the Sunday paper speed by in a blur. My eyes picked up a remarkable amount of information on the fly. I bypassed the sports, the business section, and the classified ads. I slowed now and then just to see what was going on. The oil spill off the Santa Teresa coast was in its 190th day. Funny Girl and Goodbye Columbus were playing at the local movie theater along with Planet of the Apes. There was talk that Don Drysdale's 14-year pitching career might be coming to an end because of a recurrent injury, and a Westinghouse two-speed automatic washer was selling for $189.95. When I reached Monday's paper, I slowed to a dead stop and scanned it page by page. On Monday, August 4th, 5 column inches were devoted to the discovery of the body near the Grayson Quarry in Lompoc. Con Dolan and Stacy Oliphant were both mentioned by name, but there was little to report. The next day, August 5th, in a column called North County Events, I caught the second squib. By then the autopsy had been done and the cause of death was detailed. The same few physical traits were noted, hair and eye color, height and weight, in hopes of identifying the girl. I cranked the reel forward through Wednesday and Thursday of the same week. Thursday's paper included a brief follow-up with the same information I'd read in the initial account. Both gave a brief description of the girl's clothing, detailing the dark blue voile blouse and the daisy-patterned pants. Neither article specified the color of the pants. I knew from police reports that the daisies were dark blue, a red dot at each center, on a ground of white, but if you relied strictly on this data, it would be natural to assume the daisies were daisy-colored, as Roxanne Fought It so aptly summed it up. Factoring in her certainty about the torn earlobe, the big feet, the big-boned wrists, and the closely bitten nails, I doubted the girl she'd dealt with was actually our Jane Doe. It was always possible, of course. Eyewitness testimony is notoriously shaky, easily influenced, subject to subtle modification with each telling of the tale. Roxanne had admitted she'd gone back to reread the very clippings I was looking at myself. I didn't wholly discount what she said, but I wondered at its relevance to our investigation. Stacy had hoped to establish a timeline, working backward from Roxanne's encounter to Cloris Bargo's sighting of the girl hitchhiking outside Colgate. Now Cloris had recanted, and I suspected Roxanne's observations were too tainted to be of use. I fast-forwarded. That same week, on August 9th, five people, including film and television actress Sharon Tate, were found slain in a Bel Air home. 2 days later, Lino and Rosemary LaBianca were discovered murdered in a manner similar to the Tate slayings. I tracked forward again, but there was no further mention of Jane Doe. I jotted a few notes on my index cards and then made copies of the news stories, paid for them at the counter, and returned to my car. It was just after 5, and Con was doubtless at CC's, knocking back happy hour drinks on a 2-for-1 deal. For my sake, I hoped he hadn't been at it long. I spotted his car as soon as I pulled up in front, but the area was otherwise deserted. Across the street at the bird refuge, two women in sweats were just starting a walk, chatting with animation. Closer to the water, a mother looked on placidly as her 5-year-old child fed day-old bread to the gulls under a sign that read, "Please do not feed the birds." I went into CC's, pausing in the doorway to let my eyes adjust. A plank of daylight had fallen in the open door, enhancing the contrast between CC's and the outside world. The place was dark. There was no one in the front room except the bartender and a waitress engaged in intimate conversation. Stacy and Dolan were seated in a booth in the rear. Stacy got up when I appeared. He was looking better today. I said, "Hi, am I late?"
"Not at all," Dolan said.
Both had glasses in front of them. Dolan's contained whiskey dark enough to pass for iced tea. Stacy's was empty except for the ice cubes and a wad of freshly squeezed lime. Dolan hauled himself to his feet just as Stacy sat down.
"What can I get you?"
"Water's fine for now. I may switch later."
"I'll take another Tanqueray and tonic."
Dolan frowned.
"You just had one. I thought the doc didn't want you mixing meds with booze."
"Or else what? I drop dead?"
"Don't worry, I'll take full responsibility. I'd be doing myself a favor."
Dolan gestured impatiently and then moved off to the bar. I slid into the booth and put my shoulder bag on the seat beside me. He said,
"How'd your day go?"
"So-so. I'll tell you about it as soon as he gets back." Stacy reached into his vest pocket and removed a pipe and a tobacco pouch, then filled the bowl. He fished around in another pocket for a pipe pick and tamped down the tobacco before he took out a wooden kitchen match and slid the head along the underside of the table. I waited while he puffed at the pipe. The smoke was sweet-smelling, like a meadow full of dried hay. I said, "You're as bad as he is." Stacy smiled.
"On the other hand, suppose I only have a few months left. Why deny myself? It's all in your perspective."
"I guess it is." We engaged in idle chit-chat until Dolan returned, bearing a tray with my water and two fresh drinks for them. He'd added napkins, a bowl of popcorn, and a tumbler of nuts.
"Look at this guy buying dinner for us," Stacy said. "Hey, I got class, more than I can say for you."
The air was cool and free of cigarette smoke, which Dolan corrected for as soon as he sat down. I didn't bother to complain. Stacy's pipe tobacco and Dolan's cigarette smoke masked the faint whiff of noxious gases from the excavation site outside. Dolan helped himself to a handful of nuts, popping them in his mouth one by one while he looked at me.
"What'd you get?"
"You're not gonna like it," I went on with a summary of my travels, starting with Cloris Bargo and the lie she'd told. Stacy said,
"I talked to her twice myself, and she never said a word about that."
"It's my charm and finesse."
"Well, shit. I didn't realize she was married to Joe Mandel. He worked with us on this."
"I know. I remembered the name." Dolan said,
"I can't believe she was blowing smoke up our skirts. She actually admitted that?"
"Well, yeah. She said at the time she couldn't see the harm." Stacy said,
"Oh, let's leave that one alone. No sense butting into their business. I tell you what we might do, though, is ask Joe if he could locate Jane Doe's effects for us. It'll be good to take a look. Might spark an idea. I'll make a call and clear it with the sheriff. Don't think he'd object, but you never know about these things."
He made a note to himself and turned back to me.
"What else?"
After I left her, I drove on up to Lompoc, stopping off at Gull Cove, which is closed, by the way. I laid out my conversation with Roxanne Fott, what she'd said, and where the story she'd told me varied from what we knew. I gave them copies of the news clippings to demonstrate my point. I think she lifted the details from these, which means we can't rely on her. I believe she encountered someone, but it wasn't necessarily our Jane Doe.
"Too bad. Sounds like a dead end," Dolan said.
Stacy said,
"Dead ends are a given. That's how these things go. We're bound to run into a few along the way. All that tells us is to back up and look somewhere else. Lucky we found out about it now before we wasted any more time on it." "Knocks our hitchhiking theory all to hell," Dolan said. "Maybe so, maybe not. She could have gone to Lompoc by train or bus and hitched a ride from there."
I said to Dolan, "What about the vehicles seen in the area? Any way to check those out?"
"Johansson said something about a hippie van. We could track down that guy. What's his name?"
"Vogel."
"Right, him. Why don't we see what he remembers?"
"It's a long shot," I said.
"So's everything else we've come up with so far."
Stacy let that remark pass, still fixating on his original point about where the girl had come from.
"Another possibility is she bummed a ride to Lompoc with a friend, someone she stayed with till she hit the road again."
Dolan made a sour face.
"Would you quit obsessing? We went over that before. If she'd had friends in the area, they'd have wondered what happened as soon as she disappeared. Not if she told them she was on her way north. Suppose she stays in Lompoc a couple of nights and then leaves for San Francisco. She goes out the door, has a run-in with the devil, and ends up dead. They'd still put two and two together as soon as the story broke."
Stacy stirred irritably.
"We're not gonna find answers to every question we ask."
"So far we haven't found answers to anything," I remarked. Stacy waved that aside.
"Maybe our mistake is assuming she's from somewhere else. Suppose she's local. Someone kills her and then makes up a story explaining where she's gone. That's why she wasn't reported missing. It's part of the cover-up."
Dolan was shaking his head.
"What's wrong with that?"
Dolan sat back in the booth.
"No one exists in a vacuum. She must have had family and friends. She worked, went to school. She did some damn thing. Somebody must have wondered. Essentially, this girl dropped off the face of the earth, and you're telling me no one noticed? There's something off about that."
I said, "But Dolan, think of all the kids who disappeared in those days. There must be dozens unaccounted for. Families probably still fantasize they'll show up one day." Stacy said,
"Why don't we forget that angle and come at it from the other direction?"
"Which is what?" I asked.
What we talked about before. Assume Frankie killed her and see if we can find a way to make it stick.
Based on what? Make that leap and we could end up spinning our wheels, I said.
We're doing that anyway. The exercise is only pointless if it turns out we're wrong. What do you say, Con?
I'm with you on that one. We'd be no worse off. I've always thought Frankie had a hand in it.
Stacy turned to me. I said, you're the boss.
My thought exactly. Let me show you what I got.
He opened a manila folder and removed two connected sheets of computer paper with perforated edges. I peered at the pale print. There, in abbreviated form, was Frankie Miracle's criminal history, starting with his first arrest in Venice, California, in January of 1964. Stacy picked up the paper and began to rattle off the long string of his offenses.
I love this guy. Look at this. 1964, kid's 21 years old, arrested for drunkenness and resisting arrest. Fined $25 and put on a year's probation. Well, okay, no problem. His first contact with the law.
That we know of,
Dolan said. Stacy smiled.
That's right. But boys will be boys. They're not going to execute the lad for public drunkenness. In May that same year, he was arrested for burglary and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Probably screwed a 13-year-old. That'd be about his speed. Put on probation. In February of 65, he was arrested for another burglary. He pleaded guilty. Sentence was 6 months in jail and probation. Judge is really cracking down on him, he said, tongue in cheek. June 1965, burglary again. This time his probation's revoked and he's sentenced to state prison, 6 months to 15 years. Released after serving 10 months. December 1965, drunk and disorderly, assault, and marijuana possession. Admitted for psychiatric evaluation and treatment of drug and alcohol dependency. Stacy snorted derisively. Ugh, this guy's a creep. We all know that. April 1966, burglary and escape. November 1966, robbery, kidnapping, attempted rape. This time they threw an assault and possession of a dangerous weapon. Ooh. March 1967, another burglary. Oh, and here's a good one. I can't believe this guy's back on the street. In January 1968, Frankie abducted a woman from a supermarket parking lot. He was later arrested on charges of kidnap, assault, robbery, oral copulation, sodomy, and attempted murder. You better believe she hasn't had a good night's sleep since she ran into him. January 1969, attempted kidnap, statutory rape, contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Oh, now we're getting down to business. In March 1969, he was picked up on charges of armed robbery, assault, and attempted murder. Case dismissed. Cops probably beat a confession out of him, and the public defender had the whole thing thrown out. Sometime in June, he met a 16-year-old girl named Iona Mathis. He was married to her, briefly, 6 months, I think. About as long as some of his jail time, as it turns out. Which brings us to Venice, California. Late July, when Frankie killed Kathy Lee Pierce. Stacy shook his head. God bless the courts. If they'd done the job right, they could have saved her life.
I said, how'd he manage to get away with all that shit?
Easy,
Dolan said. He stubbed out one cigarette and fired up the next.
He knew how to work the system. Every time he was charged with multiple crimes, he'd plead guilty to one in exchange for the others being dropped. You haven't met Frankie. He can be as charming as all get out. He had judges and prosecutors bending over backwards trying to give him a chance to straighten up and fly right.
Stacy returned the report to the manila folder.
A lot of times he was sentenced to state prison under the old indeterminate sentence system. Other times he was released on automatic parole. Longest he ever went between crimes was this period between March of 67 and November of 68.
Dolan said,
bet you a dollar he just didn't get caught. He hasn't gone that long between crimes since he started out. Probably right about that. If you look at the pattern, you can see the stakes go up. Violence escalates. The stretch between crimes starts getting shorter and shorter until he killed Kathy Lee. For that one, he only served 17 years on a life sentence, so he's still lucking out. If I were her parents, I'd be pissed as hell.
I said. What else do we have? Dolan pulled a battered notebook from his jacket pocket and began to leaf through the pages. He clicked his ballpoint pen.
Frankie's cellmates. Turns out there were 12 altogether, but half the last known addresses are incorrect. We got 2 in state prison and 1 serving time in a federal prison camp in Yankton, South Dakota. I know the whereabouts of 3 for sure, Lorenzo Rickman, Pudgy Clifton, and John Luchek.
Stacy said,
Scratch Luchek. He was killed in a 2-car accident in 1975. Drunk hit him head on. Right. That's the information I have.
Dolan drew a line through the name.
Rickman's out on parole. Word has it he's been a real good boy of late, working as an auto mechanic at a place out in Colgate. I got the name here somewhere. Stacy'll stop by Monday to have a chat with him. Which leaves Clifton, who's currently at the tail end of 90 days on a misdemeanor possession. I picked up mug shots of all these guys in case you need something to refresh people's memories. I mixed in some unrelated photos so we can't be accused of biasing the witnesses, assuming we find a few. Let's be optimistic. It doesn't cost anything, Stacy said.
Dolan passed 1 pack of photos to me and 1 to Stacy, who said,
We'll let Kinsey talk to Pudgy. He's the type who'd respond to her feminine wiles.
Like I got some.
Don't underestimate yourself.
Dolan said,
That leaves Frankie. You and I can draw straws, but let's hold off on that until we contact the other 2.
Stacy winced and then stood up abruptly, saying,
Oh, shit, hang on a sec.
Dolan said,
What's wrong?
Stacy groaned, then sucked in air through his teeth, his face tense.
Damn back seizing up. Jeez, that hurts. Pain shooting all the way down my leg. What's the doctor say? How do I know? This ain't death at my door. I told you, I pulled a muscle. I can't call the oncologist for every little thing.
He leaned sideways, stretching. After a moment, he stood upright, taking a long, slow, deep breath.
Better? Much. Sorry to interrupt. Damn thing caught me by surprise. Would you quit the self-diagnosis and call a guy? The doctor's a woman, you sexist prick. You ought to give some serious thought to the assumptions you make. Quit the bullshitting, Stace. This is all a big smokescreen. You keep acting like you've only had the back pain for the past 2 days when you've complained of it for weeks. You should have had the docs take a look while you were in the hospital. It wasn't hurting me then. Oh, for heaven's sake. You know what? This is called denial. This is you trying to minimize a problem that could be damn serious. Hell, give me the gal's name and I'll call her myself. No, you won't. Then you call. I will. I was gonna do that. Now. Con, cut it out. It's past 5. She's probably left for the day. Then call the service, leave Cece's number, and have her paged. We can wait. You don't call her, I will. I'm sick of hearing you bellyache. You don't even know her name. I'll find out. Don't be ridiculous. Quit arguing. Maybe she'll give you some Valium to help you sleep at night.
Stacy shook his head.
I hate making a fool of myself because of you.
Despite his grumbling and protests, he did go off to find a phone. Dolan and I sat without looking at each other. I didn't like the sound of it any more than he did. Finally, I said, Are the 2 of you okay? You seem testy.
We're fine. He's just pissing me off. It's not about his back. The man's depressed. He thinks the cancer's spread, and that's why he doesn't want to get it checked.
I missed that, I guess. He seemed fine as far as I could tell. I mean, aside from his back.
That's because he puts on an act for your benefit. You should have heard him before you showed. The shit's wearing him down. If he'd had a gun on him, he'd have blown his brains out. He's that close.
Dolan held up his thumb and index finger 1/4 inch apart. You're not serious.
I am. He wasn't even going to do the chemo until I talked him into it. As far as he's concerned, this is the end of the line, so why play it out? Get the damn thing over with, is his attitude.
But suppose the cancer's moved into his bones.
Now, damn it, don't you start. Don't be so negative.
I'm just saying, I can understand where he's coming from.
Well, keep your opinion to yourself.
My opinion's not relevant. He can do anything he wants. It's his life. Wrong! He could use a pep talk. He needs someone to make him realize how selfish it is.
To kill himself? How so?
People who commit suicide are the ultimate narcissists. What makes him think everything revolves around him? I'm in this, too. 30 years down the drain, and all because he's a cowardly damn chicken shit and won't see this through.
But what if he's terminal? I don't understand what you want.
I want him to think about someone else for a change.
If you don't get to think about yourself when you're dying, when do you? I said. Stacy reappeared moments later, and we dropped the conversation. He declined to sit, remaining by the table with his fists pressed into the small of his back. Dolan fired up another cigarette, pausing to cough into his fist.
What'd she say?
Stacy waved the cigarette smoke away from his face. She'll see me first thing tomorrow morning, maybe take an X-ray or do a CT scan.
What's the matter with her? Did you tell her how bad it is? She should see you right now and find out what the hell's going on. God damn it! Quit nagging! This isn't an emergency, so lay off that stuff. Anyway, I'm tired and it's time to go home. I can't be sitting here drinking all night like some I could name. Sit down, you haven't had dinner yet. You have to eat. It's my treat. I got food at my place. You two stay. I can get a cab.
I'll take you, I said. My car's right outside.
You don't have to do that. I can manage on my own.
Really? I don't mind. I need to get home myself. I reached for my shoulder bag and took out the keys. Stacy was already moving toward the door as I slid out of the booth. Dolan stubbed out his cigarette.
I'll take care of it.
In the end, we left at the same time, Stacy in Dolan's car and me in mine. I watched Dolan turn off, heading toward the freeway. I took a right on Cabana Boulevard and followed the road as it wound along the beach. It was not quite dark, but a fog was rolling in off the ocean, enveloping the shore. I parked in Henry's driveway. He'd be home tomorrow in the late afternoon. I let myself into his place where I did a quick tour, making sure all was in order. No broken water pipes, no power outages, and no sign of disturbances. For a moment I stood in his kitchen, drinking in the lingering scent of yeast and cinnamon. Henry's home-baked sweet rolls. Surely I could survive one more day. I was home minutes later, safely tucked away for the night. 5:56 on a Friday evening, and I had no plans. I made an olive and pimento cheese sandwich on whole wheat bread, which I cut into quarters. I poured myself a glass of wine and settled on the couch, where I took up the Jane Doe file and started back at page 1. Sometimes you work because there's nothing else to do. Chapter 8. At 1:35 that morning, I was awoken from a sound sleep. Dolan on the phone calling from the ER at St. Terry's.
Stacy's back got worse after I dropped him off. He called me at midnight and asked me to bring him in. They took one look at him and ran it up the dock on call. I'm waiting to hear what the fella has to say.
You want me to come over?
Hang on a sec.
He put a hand over the mouthpiece and conducted a muffled conversation with someone else, then returned to the line.
I'll call you back in a bit, soon as I find out what's going on.
I replaced the handset, now wide awake. If Dolan intended to phone again, there was really no point in going back to sleep. I flipped on the light and fumbled for my running shoes. Given my new efficiency measures, I was fully suited up in sweats and crew socks. I needed only brush my teeth and run wet hands through my mop, and I was ready to go. I parked on a side street across from the hospital emergency entrance. I love the town at that hour. Traffic is sparse, the streets are empty, most businesses are shut down. The temperature had dropped into the 40s, and the lights in the emergency room looked inviting. Apparently the usual weekend trauma fest hadn't gotten underway as yet, because the front desk was deserted and all was quiet. I found Dolan reading a magazine in the reception area. He rose when he saw me. Without even thinking, I gave his cheek a buss. How's he doing?
They're in the process of admitting him. I could have saved you a trip. I tried calling you back, but I guess you'd already left by then.
Oh, don't worry about it. I was up anyway. What now? Will they let you see him again?
They gave him something for the pain, and he's out of it.
You probably won't know the difference, but I'll feel better if I do. After that, I thought I'd make a run over to his place and pick up some of his things, toothbrush and comb, stuff like that.
Why don't I find us a cup of coffee? There's bound to be a vending machine on the premises somewhere.
We sat together for half an hour, sipping treacherous-smelling, lukewarm coffee from thick paper cups with handles like flat-folded butterfly wings. He said,
"What were you doing home? I was all set to leave a message. I figured you'd be out on a date."
"People don't date anymore. At least I don't," I said.
"Why not? What's wrong with it? How else are you going to meet someone?"
"I don't want to meet anyone. I'm fine, thanks so much. What about you? You're single. Are you dating these days?"
"I'm too old."
"Me too," I said, peering over at him. "How long ago did your wife die?"
10 months today."
He was silent for a moment.
"I'll tell you what's been hard. She bugged me for years to go on a cruise. I hated the whole idea. Tahiti, Alaska. She'd bring me color brochures full of these pictures of happy couples, all of them 30 years old, standing on the deck holding champagne flutes. Sunset, romance. Inside it'd be a picture of this mountain of fools you could stuff yourself with 24 hours a day. Just the sight of it's enough to make your ulcers perforate. I hate being cooped up, and I was worried I'd be stranded with a bunch of fools. Does that sound unreasonable?"
"You think it was a cruise she wanted, or just a trip someplace?" Dolan turned and gave me a look.
"I never thought to ask."
I got back to my place at 2:45 a.m. and then slept restlessly until 10. The Santa Teresa County Jail is housed in a 25,000-square-foot building, 2 stories, 120 beds, designed to be staffed by only 2 corrections officers, one of whom monitors the state-of-the-art security panel with its bank of television screens. Still feeling half-dead from lack of sleep, I pulled the VW into one of the slots out front and went through the main entrance doors, where I picked up a copy of the visitation request form. I filled in my name and gave it to the clerk at the counter, then hung out in the lobby area while the word went down to Pudgy that he had a visitor. I could picture his puzzlement, as I was reasonably certain he'd never heard of me. Curiosity or boredom must have gotten the better of him, because the clerk returned and said he'd agreed to see me. She gave me the booth number where I could meet him. 10 of us entered the elevator, 2 lone women and 3 mothers with assorted small kids. I pressed down, wondering if I looked like the sort of person who'd have a boyfriend in jail. The elevator descended by inches while we all secretly worried about getting stuck. Once the doors opened on the floor below, we spilled into a room that was probably 20 feet by 20. Molded beige and gray plastic armchairs, chunky and square, were arranged in a double row down the middle of the room, with additional seats around the perimeter. The floor was a glossy beige vinyl tile. The walls were cinder block, painted a matte two-tone beige. A posted sign read, "Keep feet off wall," though there was nothing to suggest how one might accomplish violating such a, well, feat. In the visitor's room, 8 stationary stools with a handset at each place were lined up on either side of a large glass-enclosed aisle. I sat down and placed my shoulder bag at my feet. I rested my elbows on the counter, feeling as if I were seated at the lunch counter of an old five and dime. I knew from the police report that Pudgy was born Cedric Costello Clifton in 1950, the same year I was. He had a birthday coming up, June 7th, so I'd aced him by a month and 2 days. The door opened on the jail side, and a few inmates straggled in on the other side of the glass, hands linked behind their backs, a requirement any time they were moved from place to place. Pudgy appeared and took a seat on a stool that was a match for mine. His face was moon-shaped, and he wore glasses with big round frames perched on a surprisingly dainty nose. His facial hair was disorganized, rough mustache and a beard that ran from patchy to thick as it drifted across his cheeks. There were miscellaneous whiskers scattered almost to his eyes. His dark hair looked jangled, a texture that on a woman would be attributed to a bad home permanent. He wore the usual jail garb, a white T-shirt, blue cotton elastic-waisted pants, and rubber shoes. I've seen similar outfits on surgical residents in the corridors of St. Terry's. He was bulky through the shoulders, his chest and biceps bulging from years of pumping iron. The hair on his left forearm only partially masked an entire gallery of elaborate tattoos, a spider web, a skull wearing a sombrero, and a graphically portrayed sex act. There was also a big-breasted woman with flowing black tresses whose torso was laid out between his elbow and wrist. His right arm seemed to be bare of art. He studied me for a long time. Through sheer effort, I held his gaze without breaking eye contact. Finally, he lifted the handset on his side of the glass and said,
"Hey, how you doing?"
I held the handset loosely against my ear. "I'm good, Mr. Clifton. How about yourself?"
"I'm doing okay."
"I know you." "My name's Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator. I appreciate your seeing me."
"Why don't you skip the Mr. shit and tell me what you want?"
Behind the round lenses of his glasses, his eyes were a mild hazel under ill-kempt brows. "I was wondering if you'd answer a few questions." A slight smile appeared.
"About what?"
"Something that happened in 1969.
"Why ask me?"
"This isn't about you, it's about someone else."
"Goody. And who's that?"
"You remember being arrested in Lompoc in August of 69?
"Yeah,"
he replied with all the caution of someone who's not quite sure what he's agreeing to. "You gave the officer a home address in Creosote, California. Can you tell me where that is? I never heard of it." I had looked it up on the map, but in the manner of a polygraph, I thought I'd start with baseline questions, whose truth value was easily verified.
"Little town out near Blythe,
2 miles this side of the Arizona line." "How'd you end up in Lompoc?"
"I was traveling to San Francisco. I had a buddy who had just come back from 6 months living on the streets up there. He told me you could buy dope right out on Haight. Lewds, grass and hash, peyote, acid. Free sex and free clinics to treat crabs in the clap if you picked up a dose. Sounded like a good deal to me."
"Still does, come to think of it.
Any more you lay a hand on a chick, she blows the whistle on you."
I glanced at the sheet of paper I'd taken from my bag, though I knew what it said. "According to this, you were picked up for vagrancy and possession of an illegal substance." He loosened up at that, face creasing into a smile. Apparently, he'd made an entire career out of substance abuse and denial.
"What a crock of shit that was. I'm standing on the side of the road, thumbing a ride, when this cop car comes by. Couple rednecks in uniform, fucking pigs. These two pull over and pat me down. Turns out I had some pot on me. One fucking joint. And for this, I'm locked up. I should have sued for harassment and false arrest."
"You'd hitchhiked?"
"I was 19 years old. You don't have a car, that's what you do."
We're interested in anyone who might have seen a young girl hitchhiking in the area. 17, 18 years old, dyed blonde hair, blue eyes. She was probably 5'3", 125 pounds.
That's half the girls I knew. All of them looked like that except the ones porked up on grass. Ever notice that? Girls that smoke too much dope and munch themselves up to twice their normal weight. Either that or all the fat ones were on the street in those days hoping to get laid. Who else would have them?
"That's a wholesome attitude." Pudgy laughed at that, genuinely amused, while I was not. I said, "Can we get back to the subject?"
"Which is what now? I forget."
"The girl I described."
"Sure. What'd she do?"
"She didn't do anything. Her body..."